This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the American Monetary Association's podcast, where we explore how monetary policy impacts the real lives of real people and the action steps necessary to preserve wealth and enhance one's lifestyle.
Hey, listeners, I've got Thomas, our in-house economist, back on the line with us. We told you we would talk to you a little bit about the World Economic Forum, that annual event with the world's elites in the financial industry, and it just goes to show you that the financial industry is the world industry, so there's a lot to it. Anyway, Thomas, welcome back. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Fine, thank you. So we talked about the happiness quotient and whether or not that's related to GDP and the productivity of a population in a country. A little bit about inflation versus deflation. This is a huge issue, obviously, for how one might invest and so forth. It sounds like you think, and this is probably contrary to what I think, that there's going to be a little bit of deflation coming up, and you don't think it's that bad? Tell us more.
If inflation was measured the way it was back in the 70s, then I don't think there's any way we'd see deflation. But with the way it is measured now and the trend of disinflation since the 1970s, if that trend continues, then deflation could be the case in 2020. The average inflation rate has gone from around 6% in the 70s to 5% in the 80s, and then 3% and 2.5%. And it looks like this decade it might be below 2%.
So the target, the Fed's target, is to have inflation around 2%, and they're playing to the Phillips curve, which is the inflation versus employment theory. I think there's some legitimacy to that. I mean, what would be the cause of that? Technology is a deflationary force. Monetary policy is an inflationary force because it's so irresponsible, largely. What would be the cause of deflation, or, you know, just a sort of at par environment where there's just no inflation or deflation, just not much is happening at all, sort of a I don't want to say stagnation because it doesn't mean the economy is necessarily stagnant, but just nothing much is happening on the inflation scale, I guess I'll say.
Yeah, I think the technology is certainly part of it. The globalization of the supply chain has put downward pressure on prices for a while now. If that keeps going, you know, it's hard to see real strong inflation. And then the way we account for the substitution of goods, so say Uber or Airbnb, they put downward pressure on prices. And it's not like they're not decreasing the demand for goods. They're just putting downward pressure on the supply. So in essence, they're pushing up demand, which boosts economic growth, but they're also putting pressure on the price point. And I think, you know, if that continues, then we could see what we saw in the 1870s to the 1900s, where we saw bouts with deflation, but overall economic growth was pretty strong.
Mm-hmm. How deflationary is technology? I mean, it's pretty deflationary, isn't it?
Well, I think you already know the answer to this.
But yeah, I do. I'm asking for the benefit of the listeners.
A lot of the questions you ask.
Yeah, right.
I know you do. Like Airbnb, does it put downward pressure on prices? And when I looked at it, it looks to me like it at least puts a couple percentage points downward pressure on hotel revenue.
Yeah, you know, that's really interesting. I'm glad you brought up Airbnb, or let's make it even more broad. Let's just talk about the sharing economy. So the sharing economy is a technology at heart because it really is enabled by technology. Without the kind of technology we have nowadays, there's no way you could coordinate all this unused capacity in our economy. And I was listening to an audiobook yesterday, or maybe a news story, and it talked about this company that is now coordinating empty semi-truck space for shipping cargo, right? And how 40% of the truck trips, the truck is empty. And that's a tremendous waste, of course, right? And if you could fill all of that space and use all of that unused capacity, it would obviously be dramatically more efficient. And so, you know, this is, we'll call it the Uber and Lyft of semi-trucks, right? And whether it be the bicycles, the Airbnb concept, the ride-sharing, whatever sharing economy concept it is, it's putting a lot of unused assets to work. And once those assets are all used, the price discovery has occurred, right? And then after that usage happens, you can start to see whether or not there will ultimately be inflation afterwards. Because initially, it's downward pressure. Like certainly taxi cabs have had to compete with Lyft and Uber, and they've become cheaper or they've just gone away, right? And so it's a deflationary thing. But once you kind of work that through the system and all the capacity is filled again, then, I don't know, maybe the monetary pressures come back into play, right? And cause inflation.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought. I hadn't thought of it that way. It makes sense that after the bottom point of prices are discovered, that there's nowhere to go but up.
So, Thomas, let me couch that in the global labor market perspective, okay? I have this weird theory. I could be totally off here, but I've said it before, so it's not the first time I've said it on the show, that Nixon, I mean, it's just too much of a coincidence that in the early 70s, Nixon took us off the gold standard, right? He made the final disconnect in 1971. You know, it was right around the time that he took that historic trip to China and opened up China. Was he this brilliant president, possibly, that saw that, you know, because the dollar was no longer tethered to gold at all, that, of course, the politicians could buy votes and spend whatever they want, and inflation was coming, and it certainly did long after he was gone from office, but it certainly came, and there was the OPEC crisis and the gas lines and all of that stuff. You know, he opened up China, so we exploited this, and, you know, I don't mean that in a negative way. We sent a lot of business there, right? And that was deflationary by manufacturing in China, the workshop of the world, right? But where do you go after that? It's like almost every vestige of cheap labor around the planet has already been now used. That capacity is now utilized, right? Yeah, certainly Africa's got resources and so forth, but Africa's kind of a mess, right? There's too many tribes and governments and very fragmented. So, you know, maybe that kind of price discovery is actually happening now, you know, just the same way as it might with the sharing economy. What do you think? I know these are big, weird macro thoughts, but I stay up late night thinking about this stuff.
Oh, I like it. You know, the shift to a fiat currency, it's coincided with a ballooning in debt. And with the exception of the 1980s, well, debt grew during the 1980s. But, you know, we've seen corporate debt, government debt, student debt explode over the past few decades. And part of that is connected with the ability to issue fiat currency. It's not a problem when the GDP growth plus the inflation rate is greater than what the yield curve is, say, on the 10-year note.
Okay, explain that to us a little bit more. Unpack that one. I don't know if people understand it. I don't even know if I understand it. I mean, I know GDP and population, those need to sink a bit. Otherwise, you know, you'll have inflation or deflation as a malady. How does the yield curve come into play?
The idea is that as long as you're growing fast enough to pay off any debt issuance costs, so the, you know, the issuance cost plus the coupon rate, as long as you can pay that off, you're fine. And that's exactly what governments have done. So with the exception of a few years in the 80s, GDP growth and inflation rate, that generates the tax revenue to pay off the bonds. And as long as that's growing, say, at 2% plus 2%, the GDP growth plus inflation rate 4%, as long as that's higher than, say, the 10-year note, which I checked this morning, it was floating at about 2.73%. As long as that's growing faster, they're okay, you know? Any debt coming due can just be reissued. And as long as the coupon on that is less than GDP growth plus inflation rate, There's no pressure.
What you're talking about there is treasury bills, right? Government debt.
Yeah.
In essence,
I'm talking about
right?
treasury
yeah.
bills.
Okay. Got it. Yeah.
The same thing applies to, say, corporate debt, just replace GDP growth with total revenue growth.
Mm-hmm. Right. So it applies in the macro, the micro, and even the personal sense almost, maybe. with a household debt, even. Yeah, I don't know. You could make that as a bit of a stretch, but they can't do the same things that the public companies and the governments can, of course, but yeah, interesting.
In connection to technology, though, if we're reaching a point to where the lowest possible price point is reached on a macro scale, then you know that means there's price pressure coming up, which that's a problem, you know?
Well, it's an opportunity if you invest for inflation, like our listeners do. You mean it's a problem, meaning inflation is coming, right? In that case.
Yeah, you looked at the glass half full. I looked at the glass half empty.
Yeah, well, listen, like I say, most people really get hurt by inflation, but our clients benefit from it. And not in the normal way that most people say, hey, real estate's a good hedge against inflation. Our clients leverage that dramatically. And, you know, that has like an order of magnitude better than most real estate investors for our clients because we have a few little secrets that help them do that. So, yeah, good stuff. You know, the question I always ask people is, compared to what? Compared to what? So the U.S. has all these problems. We have, you know, $20 trillion in debt or whatever. We have these big deficits. We have this, that, and the other thing. We have divisiveness, et cetera. But compared to what? I mean, look, Europe is on the brink of some serious problems. Four countries in Europe are essentially insolvent, four decent-sized countries, the pigs I'm talking about. China is really got a tough road ahead. The World Economic Forum, they talked about both of these things. Give us an update on those.
Oh, yeah. If I were a betting man, and I guess I kind of am, I'd say that the ECB, the European Central Bank, will have lower interest rates by the end of this year than they will higher interest rates. It's just, I can't see with the weakness there that the ECB would even consider raising rates. They never raised rates like, you know, the Federal Reserve did. It put them behind the curve, and now what do? Their rates are already pretty much zero. We'll probably see a real discussion about negative rate on a currency held in banks. Not the actual currency, right? But, you know, balances held in banks. Mm-hmm. Kind of like what the Bank of Japan did.
Yeah, so that was Japan's lost two decades, not lost decade, but lost two decades. And the thing, though, that is interesting is Harry Dent was, you know, one of the first big names to argue this idea is that Japan's real problem, of course, they have all these problems, right? But their real core big problem is that they have a demographic problem, and so does China, and so does Western Europe. I mean, if you don't have young people working, paying into the system, you got a big problem. I mean, your country becomes insolvent in short order. Russia's got the same problem, too. I mean, Pat Buchanan years ago wrote that book, Death of the West, and I interviewed him on the show, and boy, that was a prescient book. I mean, I think he wrote it in the mid-90s or something, and he's right. The West is just not reproducing. I mean, the fertility rates are dismal. Nobody has kids anymore. I mean, it's really it's kind of a shocking thing. It's not really talked about very much either.
There was an article out this morning in the Wall Street Journal, I think. I'd have to double check, but the idea was that there's a trade-off between women entering the labor force and having children. You choose one or the other. I don't think some will say they can, you know, families can have both.
Yeah, contrary to popular belief of the superwoman syndrome, you know what, raising kids is a lot of work and having a career is a lot of work too. It's pretty much a trade-off, right? You can try and do both, but one is going to suffer at the expense of the other. There's just no question about it. You know, people only have 24 hours in a day. That's equal opportunity for everybody, and you can only do so much with it, right? You know, I mean, I grew up with a working mom. I didn't see her too much. I was a latchkey kid, and hey, look at how I turned out. No one would recommend
yeah.
that.
So you're the exception rather than the rule.
No, I might be the rule. I'm poking a little fun at myself here, but it's definitely true. But, you know, and Mark Stein, the political commentator, talks about this in his books. You know, you can't have a country without a population. In a few decades, Japan and Russia and Western Europe will essentially be gone. I mean, there's no people there. How can you have a country without people? And he makes a really good argument for that. But I guess the environmentalists will be happy because, you know, according to them, people are not a resource. They are the scourge of the earth. I view it the other way. I like people. I think they are a resource. I think they solve problems. Which, speaking of the environment, the elitist hypocrites in Davos, Switzerland, this year they topped the record for the most private jets there as they went to talk about how everybody should have a lower carbon footprint. Absolutely ridiculous. But I think Bill Gates, I just read an article, he invested in a company that can make gasoline from carbon dioxide in the atmosphere somehow. That's a stretch, but that's pretty amazing. And that's my point, though, Thomas. People do solve these problems. Yes, they mess up the world. I completely agree. People litter, they consume, they pollute, but they also come up with great ideas. And I just kind of have faith that people will, you know, if we have more people here, we're going to have more people to come up with great ideas. I just view people as a resource, but, you know, everybody can argue that until the cows come home, as they say, right? Okay, so...
Just once, I'd like to see you be pessimistic.
Yeah. Oh, really? You don't think I'm a pessimist sometimes? I'm really pessimistic about some things, so, you know, but I'm kind of weird. I'm optimistic and pessimistic, yeah. Well, I got to ask you, what are you, optimistic or pessimistic about the economy? Next 5 years, what's it look like?
Well, I think the next 2 years look good. Rates are still relatively low. The equity markets are up around 14% since the December downturn. Mm-hmm. Doesn't surprise me that corporate earnings came in somewhat weak for the fourth quarter of 2018. Mm-hmm. But, you know, most of that was priced into the market. That's mm-hmm. why markets collapsed in December. They expected that. And mm-hmm. There's still a good amount of growth left for the economy, you know.
Sure, yeah. So after 2 years, are you saying it depends on the presidential election or we just don't know? Or you think in 2020 things change a lot?
I'd have a hard time seeing a recession during a presidential election year. Mm-hmm. I don't think we'll see one in 2019. So that pushes it at least out to 2021.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we shall see how it all shakes out. We shall see. Okay, anything else you want to share with our listeners as we wrap it up?
Yeah, we're in the midst of the fourth industrial revolution, and times are good.
Tell us about that. Is that because it's the information revolution? I mean, we've been going through that one for a while, but what do you mean?
This is kind of a debate whether we're in the fourth or if we're still in the third. The first one was the 1760 to 1840 railroads, the steam engine, mm-hmm. you know, that boom period. And then the 1870s to 1910 mass production and electricity and assembly lines. And mm-hmm. then in the 60s, semiconductors, mainframe computers, personal computing, the internet came along. And then now... assuming we can distinguish between, you know, what we saw in the early 2000s and what we're seeing now, you know, maybe call it the digital revolution. Artificial intelligence is something worth considering. Machine learning, Internet of Things, you know, the service economy.
Right.
The depth is just amazing. In Europe, it took 120 years for the swindle. Is that what you call it? The swindle to make its way? The spindle. Sorry, the spindle.
The spindle. Okay. Right. Is this for clothing, textiles? Is that
yeah.
what you're talking about?
Yeah, okay. textiles. Yeah. It mm-hmm. took 120 years for the spindle to make it across Europe. And, uh-huh. you know, the internet took 10 years to cross the world.
Right. Yeah, it's pretty amazing. It really is an amazing time to be alive. Forgive me for sounding optimistic. But hey, listen, if you want me to get pessimistic, let's talk about culture war. I'm really pessimistic about culture. I think there's a lot of tough things happening in the culture. But as far as technology and the right strategy for dealing with the economy, I'm not saying the economy is all great or anything. I'm just saying you can adapt the strategy. And that's why I love income property, because it's very adaptable to changes in the economy, whether it be a cash flow strategy, a capital appreciation strategy, a blend of the two, whatever, you know, that varies. But yeah, we'll talk about that another time. But yeah, very interesting. And there is, it's just amazing the kinds of things we'll see. I was studying a little bit more about this amazing material, graphene, that we're all starting to hear about. That is going to revolutionize so many things and solve so many of the world's problems. It's absolutely mind-boggling. So more about that. In fact, maybe I'll share the audio from a video I watched recently on that. It's quite fascinating. Thomas, thanks for joining us today. And until next time, happy investing.
Good talking to you.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guest opinions are their own, and if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.